Professor, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Well, I've got D'Amico here. We are going to talk about some fun stuff. We actually already started talking about it, why plant churches in the city.
Yeah.
I am a city folk. So when I grew up, I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, not a huge city, but it was a city. And then my parents at 6 years old took me to rural Arkansas. So rural, in fact, I could see the edge of the world, the cliffs from where I lived. The pavement stopped, and we kept moving for like four miles on gravel roads. Like, and I, it was the worst experience of my life. We didn't have a stop sign or a stoplight in our county until I was in high school at that particular space.
Yeah.
When I could move back to a city, I totally did.
Yeah,
I love the city, and I think I think that's where all the ingenuity and innovation and the environment just is faster paced. I love that.
Yeah,
I'm not built for slow.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about planting churches in the city, and obviously, the city's different for everyone. Why, D'Amico, should we plant churches in the city?
Yeah, man. I love the city as well. I'm also from a town that's very small as well, like 600 people, 2 4-way stop signs. Don't date any of the girls because they're probably your cousin. So
the family tree is a little straight, right?
Right. which I got a fun story I can share off air, but I don't want to feed into any Mississippi stereotypes on this podcast, but I'll tell you what.
My wife is from Arkansas. I have to give an Arkansas joke every time I speak. So, in fact, that's where my parents moved me to, which is why I talk about it quite a bit. You know, I'm like, you knew that the toothbrush was invented in Arkansas, right?
Well, I didn't know that.
Because everywhere else it would have been called a teeth brush.
is that a true story or just an Arkansas joke?
I don't know. It's an Arkansas joke that I make. Might have been. I don't know.
All right.
There's another one. So Missouri's right on top of Arkansas, and they got this little boot heel there.
Yeah.
And so they've been talking about getting rid of the boot heel and giving it to Arkansas. And and the reason why is because it would simultaneously raise both states' IQ 10 points.
Hey, man, if we got anybody listening from Arkansas, we love y'all. And I have friends in Arkansas. One of my buddies, a great pastor friend, he's in Arkansas. And
that's cool.
But he's country. He ate a beaver rib the other day, and he said it was
a beaver rib.
Yep.
Wow. That's a new one for me.
Yep.
I won't lie.
But he said it was delicious. But
listen, I have learned I am not racist. I am not I'm not a very discriminate person.
Yeah.
But I love to hate on Arkansas. So yeah. I feel it. You know, I'm like, I probably should do some heart work there. I don't have a lot of prejudice in me, but I don't like Arkansas. So
Yeah.
But I live there, so I think that's why I don't enjoy it all that much.
Yeah.
But
you also love the city, so
yeah. And you know, my wife is from Arkansas. A couple family members still live down there. I love them, and I told God if he ever wanted to move me back down there, I would say yes, but I would do it through drops of blood, just like Jesus did, and said, "Please pass this cup for me."
Yeah.
But yeah.
I'm sorry. I got us distracted. I'll get us back on track. But why plant churches in the city? Like you, I love the city. There's a book that I read about the city of Houston in particular. It's called Houston, the Prophetic City. And so in this book, Peter Kleinberg argues that what's happening in Houston is a precursor for what's going to happen in the rest of the world, but maybe 10 or 20 years later in other places. So some of the diversity that's in the city of Houston. So Houston and Fort Bend County is considered one of the most diverse communities in America. Of course, New York is probably the most diverse place. But in Fort Bend County, you have the likelihood of your neighbor being a different ethnicity than you than any other place in the United States. And so I think that's one strategic reason to plant in the city, specifically in the city of Houston, the diversity and density. There's more people, there's more cultures, and there's also more opportunity for gospel multiplication. Our church is south of the Greater Third Ward in OST South Union. And right now, our church, in a lot of ways, it looks like the city of Houston. It's black, it's brown, it's black, it's Latino. It's we got some Asian folks that are coming around, white folks that are also looking like the community. And so it's beautiful to see that. And so in the city, you get a snapshot of this heavenly picture that we see of people from every tribe, nation, and tongue. So I think there's one reason, the diversity and the density. And I think another part of that, it's also that influence flows from cities. So Houston in particular, especially in the Greater Third Ward, a lot of our movers and shakers, where the Greater Third Ward is considered like the cultural epicenter of the city of Houston. So a lot of your politicians, a lot of your educators, even tech, we have the ION, that's like the tech hub. A lot of the arts and it happens in the city. And what happens, you could argue, what happens in the Greater Third Ward of Houston flows out and impacts the rest of the city. And so we're right there. We just ate at Rattle Market that was started by Chef Chris Shepherd. He's got another restaurant called Lucille's here in the city. But that restaurant sits in the El Dorado Ballroom, which used to be home to the jazz music scene in the city of Houston. And that El Dorado Ballroom is right next to Emancipation Park, where Jack Yates, who received a large parcel of land, they now developed that land. And now it's this place where music festivals happen, and they have event centers and swimming pools and all this kind of right there. So a lot of the influence that happens, particularly in the city of Houston, it's just right there in the city. So those are a couple strategic reasons, you know, the influence that is there, the diversity. And I think another influential part is we're right there with the University of Houston and then also Texas Southern University. So we have a historically black college and university in Texas Southern, and then also the University of Houston. So I'm preaching Acts 17:16-34 this Sunday. And so one of the arguments that I'm going to be making, like if you want to get something that's akin to the Areopagus or the Agora, those kind of cultural, philosophical, influential places that was similar to that back in those times, you got to think about the colleges and university. And so one of my tasks as a pastor is going to be inviting people, maybe a part of our congregation, and even building residencies so that we can impact folks on these college campuses, some of which, if you look at the University of Houston, are from some places that have no gospel presence. And so if we can reach them in the city of Houston and then them go back to wherever they are to then be gospel witnesses in their context, we have that unique opportunity in Houston because of the way that the nations have diverged and transcended into the city of Houston.
Yeah, so I was thinking about my time in Omaha as you were talking about it. So I live downtown Omaha. My wife and I did apartment ministry at the largest project in Omaha, which was right across the street from Creighton University. And so we were on national news 3 times while we lived there, not for good reasons. And, you know, it was the largest Section 8 project in not just Omaha, but in Nebraska. And there was just so much stuff. And it was this one street literally downtown, but this one street really was the segregation line between most of the African American community and then very affluent white community in Omaha. Obviously, Warren Buffett lives there, all of that. But it was like downtown is beautiful. But then you got this eyesore that just reminds you of all this, all the pain and suffering that's still there, you know, even to this day. And we lived there. My kids lived and were playing on a jungle gym, you know, 15 feet away from a drug deal, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and they were, you know, 2 and 3 years old. They had no clue what was going on.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was very interesting setup because you know, I could walk to go get coffee at some of these really amazing places, but I better be careful going the other direction to Dollar General, you know? I loved it. I loved being in that urban context.
Yep.
And, you know, we had a ton of young adults that would come over and hang out with us at the apartment complex, but would not end up at the church.
Yep.
You know, where we pastored. And so it was just a really cool ministry outpost.
Yeah.
And, you know, learning how to speak to different cultures, I was like one of seven white people in a 800 unit complex.
Yep.
And four of them lived in my house.
Yeah.
You know, and so it took us about 12 months for people to actually trust us.
Yeah. Yep.
And we had more than a few things stolen. Yep. We had a drug addict bang on our house like 2:30 in the morning. People that knew us, we loved them. We were trying to help them, you know. But I mean, there's no downtime there. Like something was always happening.
Yep.
And I just found that was really interesting. Just the juxtaposition one street could have in an urban context.
Yes, so true.
And so I could be with a millionaire 1 second, go across the street and be with somebody that's been on food stamps and can't even pay their rent.
Yep. And it wasn't just like that in Omaha, you know, right here in Houston, Old Spanish Trail and Cullen. So if you're on one side of Cullen, houses are, you know, $200,000 or less. You cross Old Spanish Trail and then you see like two or three multi-million-dollar houses just to your left. And all you did was cross the street. And so, and of course that was intentional with redlining and things like that, where, especially in Houston, you drive, you cross the street and things look totally different. Bizanet is one of those streets where prostitution is rampant. They cut down on a lot of it, but you go down Bizanet and you're on one side of it, prostitution's rampant, but you're on the other side of Bizanet, you know, you got multi-million-dollar homes, and it's amazing in that way. And I think also what you're describing too, Chesley, as you were there in Omaha, that what y'all were doing, you know, church planting, evangelizing, that is another strategy, which is church planting is one of the most effective ways to reach the unreached, because even when you were talking about, like, you were reaching out to folks and ministering to folks, they came to your, you know, they came by the crib, but they didn't come to the church. And so you're reaching people. And I think that's beautiful. Like, you know, one thing that our church used to say all the time was like, the church is first and foremost a people to belong to, rather than the event to attend. So y'all are being the church. Mm-hmm. And so those people being loved and served. But that is also just one of the best ways to engage a place, because if somebody wakes up on a Sunday and they want to go to church, they're not coming to our church. You know, right. We're in Houston where going to a church is a top 10 thing to do. So they're not coming to our,
especially in downtown Houston.
Right. So they're not coming to our church. Because our neighborhood just looks different. It's not like a place where you wake up like, hey, I'm going to drive to this side of town and worship Jesus. And so because of that, we have to go to the people. Like, the people aren't coming to us. I remember we first got in first got in the neighborhood, we'd always see this church that would put a sign out. And it's like kind of like this way to church. And every time I would drive by, I'm like, those folks, they're just driving by your sign. They're not. That's not going to draw them in. And so we have to be fishers of men. We have to go to those people and show them the worthiness of following Jesus. And then in some ways, like we're debunking myths about the church. We are in some ways teaching folks what a pastor is, because I remember going into like one of our hood grocery stores, taking one of the brothers in there who needed some help with some groceries, and they learned that I was a pastor. And then they were like, hey, do you have a private jet? I was like, do you think I would be shopping in Pie Burns?
It's
like, right. Do you think I'd be shopping here if I had a private jet? And so it's like, hey, like not. I remember another guy saying like, there's three ways to make money in our neighborhood. He's like, you could be a pimp. You could do real estate, or you could be a pastor. And so like, but that was his frame of mind. And so like, in some ways we're debunking myths and just loving people. But I think church planting, what y'all are doing, evangelizing, is the best way to reach, what folks are now calling, within the last 5 years, calling the nuns, where it's like, you know, what's your religious affiliation? You know, nuns. And I know you probably got some other names. Duns, maybe some folks that are done with the church and others. And so that's also another effective way, is to plant a church, because you have to be like, when we moved to the neighborhood, we saw ourselves as missionaries to our neighborhood. And I think you have to think that way if you're going to reach your neighbors.
Yeah, I don't think you can go ahead and go anywhere without a missionary mindset when it comes to planting.
Yep.
I see a lot of churches now that, they're struggling, and they're struggling because they're in a building that used to be a pre-gentrified space, or, or the demographics have shifted, and so they no longer look like the community they're a part of.
Yep.
But they also don't actually get out to the community that they're a part of. They live 25 minutes away from the community that they serve in.
Yeah. And
so those are all contributing factors. You know, so when you're in an urban church planting environment, and I was opposite. We lived in the projects and we pastored in the suburbs. Who does that, bro?
No. That's countercultural. Yeah. That's not normal.
No, it's not. But nobody's ever accused me of being normal, let's be honest. And then, you know, Phoenix was a very different area. Like, we lived in the community that we were serving. Like, we were 2 miles from the church.
Yeah.
But it was a suburban environment there. It was urban suburban, because we lived in Glendale, but like Phoenix proper is so big.
Yep.
And everything's urbanized.
Yep.
And so like, that was a very different experience where, you know, we had 250,000 people that lived within 3 square miles of our church building.
Yep.
You know, and so we could walk to a grocery store. We could walk to any restaurant we wanted to. You don't want to walk in the middle of August in July and August, but you could if you wanted to. It was a very different experience. But what I found even there was that our church did not look like our community either, because we had a bunch of older Dutch white people, and 30 to 40% of the young families were Hispanic in our area.
Yeah.
And so from our student ministry, when I went there, I just did everything that a church planter would do.
Yeah.
Before you know it, 30 to 40% of our student ministry was Hispanic.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and it's because we would get out in the community. We would talk, we would help talk to them on their level. We'd be at the coffee shops. We'd invite people, you know, we'd get into the schools.
Yep.
And so we didn't stay in the building.
Yeah.
And I feel like as a church planter, we get this, right? So this is important for us. When you're in an urban context, you have to do the work of being a missionary in your context to grow anything.
Right. Right. And I think also what I'm hearing you describe too, just as you were like present with people, you think about like incarnational ministry, like the way that Jesus incarnated himself, like he took on flesh and like this idea of a theology of presence, like mm-hmm. like you were in the project and you were present with your neighbors. And they'd be like, Jason, where you stay? I stay right here. You stay here? Like right here, yeah. Right here? Like, yeah, this is my neighbor yeah. too. And so it's something different about that because we moved to Houston with three families, one of which was a white family. And so like they live two streets from us. And I think it's a beautiful thing to be able to say like, hey, no, like this is our neighborhood. And that's a Christian Community Development Association principle, part of which is like relocating to the place that you're going to love and serve. And praying for the redemption of that place. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And like what we know as we're living in cities is that like there's a large concentration of image bearers there. And a lot of times what we see, what y'all saw in Omaha, what we see on the south side of Houston is these image bearers that are diverse, but it's broken, but it's mm-hmm. also beautiful and in need of redemption. And so like I try to make sure I don't focus so much on the ugly, like broken part that I forget. Like, right. Oh man, it's also like we these are these beautiful things that we get to share and be a part of. Holy. But the city, you have like this concentration of beauty and brokenness, and mm-hmm. and we're trying to be a part of the redemption of that place. And we just do that by loving and serving our neighbors. And yeah, cities are just a special place to be able to do that.
Let me ask you this, because I think for what we were doing in the inner city in Omaha, you know, we were renting and we were asked to actually, we were asked to be the couple that would be in that apartment complex. I had the organization said, hey, we've got a couple nicer ones, but we feel like we don't have anybody that will stick here the way it needs to be. And, you know, in fact, he's like, I'm concerned. I think the last people were a little racist.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to do this? I know it's not going to be a great experience, but would you be willing to do it? And it's like, yeah, we will. And then I went in the 900 square foot apartment they put us in, and with two little babies and my wife, and smelling weed come through the floor. I'm like, oh God, what did I get myself into? What did I get my wife into? You know,
I feel you, bro.
Fortunately, my wife is like, no, we're in, we're good. Mm-hmm. Good. Love yeah. That. I'm like, oh, cool. Because I was not when I went in the apartment,
yeah, thanks.
You know, and but what I realized was the trust factor. So when a white family walks into a broken down neighborhood,
yeah,
there is a lot of suspicion and skepticism. Okay. So you have your friend that moved in with you guys. How has that been? Like, they're white, they move into that area, then people are scared about gentrification
yeah.
and what's going to happen to their neighborhood. Like, have you guys dealt with any of that racial stuff as you guys have walked this route?
Yeah, yeah. We definitely have. And I think when you have that tension, you know, there's fear, but there's also opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you could be, you know, afraid of what might happen. But I think for the family that moved with us, there's also an opportunity. So there's two ways that we, you know, maybe even have even talked to this family about how you can live. You can be like the person that moved to the neighborhood to take advantage of low prices. And you're just waiting for the neighborhood to change. And then you engage with what the neighborhood is going to look like in 5 to 10 years. You're just looking at the future. You're like, hey, I'm not really worried about what it looks like now. I'm not going to engage with it now. Or you can practice that theology of presence and love and serve your neighbors, be known by them and get to know them, serve them and be served by them. And so it's been cool to see just like stories of like, hey, my neighbor boiled some crawfish and they brought us some crawfish. You know, they brought the white couple some crawfish. And so you see them being served. And there's also ways for them to serve their neighbors. But you do have that tension. And we wrestle with it, right? Because it's like, if our church was all Black and Latino, in some ways it would be easier.
Easier, yeah,
it
totally.
It will be easier because there will be less suspicion. But because our church is Black, it's white, it's Latino, it's you got some Asian folks that are here present with us too. What we talk about is this gospel diversity, and we also talk about like this radical. I don't know if we use like inequity, but I can't remember the term we use, but it's a term to say it's like we're all gonna be uncomfortable here, like nobody is gonna like show up at a Sunday gathering to be like, man, I feel perfectly comfortable, like our liturgy is gonna make somebody uncomfortable, our worship's gonna make somebody uncomfortable, our preaching is gonna make somebody uncomfortable, the way that we're out in our neighborhood is going to make somebody uncomfortable. And so we're all going to have this gospel inequity. Maybe that's a bad term, but what I'm trying to say with that is like, everybody's going to be uncomfortable. And so, and I think that's a beautiful picture of the gospel, because you have some churches that are like, we are this assimilate to that culture. But what we're saying is like, no, we see all of this diversity. How can we love and serve our neighbors so that when someone who shows up is maybe Pacific Islander or Asian, they show up and be like, oh, well, this church, they do Asian Pacific Islander month, where they're highlighting folks from this culture. Or our worship leader, he's a Black brother, he's biracial, but he married a woman from Honduras. And so like they're speaking Spanish in their home. And so he's maybe like two or three Sundays ago, we started singing worship in Spanish. We did one Spanish song. So we did like the English version and the Spanish version. And so it was beautiful because, you know, it was two brothers and sisters behind me that were singing in Spanish because that was their first language. And like, I'm trying to say this hard Spanish word. And I was struggling. So after service, I'm like, how do you say? And it was like incomparable. I was like, incomparable. And I'm like, okay. So I'm like struggling. But I think but it's also like to see him, who one of the brothers who's like English is his second language, to see him praying in English, but knowing it'd be a lot easier for him to pray in Spanish.
Pray in Spanish.
And so, but it's this. It's this radical discomfort that we all feel. And so the family that moved with us, a white family, they adopted a Black son. They have a biracial Black and Latino son, and they have a white son. And one of the funniest things from this family, y'all still laugh about today, their white son goes to this pretty much all Black school, and they they did like a hair care day. So their white son had on a do-rag.
Oh, there you go.
And he was just smiling so big in the picture. You can see it was amazing. I still laugh about it today, just randomly. But you do deal with that. You know, so for that family, you know, sometimes we just check in, like, man, how y'all doing? Y'all doing okay? Because it is.
That's all we need to.
Yeah, but it is uncomfortable. But they also wanted to be with us because now their oldest son has, you know, two Black pastors that get to model for him what's like to be a godly Black man. And so like you, and then we have more people than we thought that. I think the term is like transracial adoption, maybe where a white couple adopts children that are Black or Latino, and so you see that and they're at our church because like, okay, they want their children to have the model for their young children, like what it means to be a godly, you know, black man. And so we see that. But it's uncomfortable at times. And sometimes, like, even when we do like prayer walks or outreach events, you know, sometimes it's just like, man, I wonder how our neighbors feel. Cause like, you know, they're probably feeling like, man, like what, you know, like to your question, like, is a neighborhood gentrifying? I remember there was a story where there's a white woman and a black guy from the neighborhood was like, man, you know, the neighborhood is changing when you see a white woman walking her dog. And she just happened to be walking her dog. And it's just like, but that's kind of like the picture, right? Like, if you see you see a white woman jogging, you like, you know where you at? Like, you
are. Yeah, are you sure?
You sure? This like, this neighborhood ain't that safe yet. You know, I'm like, it's getting there. But,
right.
But so, opportunities, you know, I think when you feel that tension, you know, that could be fear or there's opportunity. And so we're just kind of pressing into our folks like, yeah, there's an opportunity here for us to do things different. Because it's like, if you're in a neighborhood and you walk by your neighbor, because I sometimes I see this, like, walk by a neighbor and they act like they don't see me. I'm going to just say, hey, how you doing?
What's up?
Yeah. You stop me. You know. But it's also been encouraged to see your neighbors reaching out to me.
Yeah. And I really love what you guys are doing, because it's not, I mean, it's, you can't run the attractional church playbook. You just, you can't do it. It doesn't work as well. That's why actually multi-sites don't plant urban cores.
Right.
You know? And so if they do, they automatically, the ones that do, I appreciate because they know it's a net loss on their book, period.
Yep.
They just know it is.
Yep.
So there's a level of respect and honor that I have for a church that says, while we know it's never going to be in the black, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, so that's helpful. But, you know, as a church planter, you can't run the playbook. So what have you guys had to do that is different? Obviously, I think this community development piece that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But what else?
Yeah. Yeah, I think community development is a large part of it. And what some of that I learned from a mutual friend of ours in Omaha. He got shot in the face not too long ago.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. True. And I just stopped at a red light and thought about him because some kids were like hustling at the red light, and so the kids, two of the kids had been to our church like maybe like three Sundays ago, but they're just like hustling, selling sodas and waters. But I think, like, so for us, it's like trying to create these entrepreneurial ventures so that one thing that, like, even from Acts 17, Paul he's grieved when he sees what's happening in Athens. He's grieved, but he steps in, and when he steps in, with the truth of the gospel. So one of the things that grieved me is, like, we were taking and providing people the truth of the gospel, but some of our neighbors still need jobs.
Yeah.
They need to provide for their families. And so, you know, part of what we're trying to do too is these entrepreneur efforts so that we can employ our neighbors so that they can use that as a step up to their next thing. So I think that community development part, whether it's, you know, maybe some of the other things we're doing is connecting people to the right places if they need, like, IDs, if they need social security cards, if they need just maybe like little practical things like that that just help our neighbors get to that next thing. You know, I think that's a big part of it. And the development part is, it's the long game, right? It's like, you know, it's easier to just give our neighbors groceries. You know, it's more costly. But the hard part is going to be making sure that our neighbors have a job so that they can afford to buy themselves, you know, their own groceries. So we had a neighbor recently who we had been helping, serving. He needed an ID, he needed social security card, he needed, you know, to be able to, you know, get groceries. And so we had a sister from our church that was able to help him get maybe two out of those three things. And yesterday he had a follow-up call around him getting like that third thing. And so You know, yeah. I think it's trying to make sure that our neighbors aren't utterly dependent on us, and we're moving them towards that developmental part where we're developing them to be less dependent on us and more independent on us. We have tables at our church, and so part of that is like outreach. And then, you know, so we're doing events so that we can love and engage our neighbors. We have three apartment complexes near our church, and so that's going to be part of our strategy, is targeting those apartment complexes. Apartment life people would say that most people who live in apartments just don't go to church. You know, it's just a low percentage of folks go to church. So we'll be targeting those apartment complexes. We'll be working with engaging college students, cultural and philosophical epicenters of our of our city. So we'll be engaging college students. We have a high school that we'll be working with, just trying to see like, okay, who are the youth that are at this local high school that's often struggling?
Right.
How can we step in? Maybe they need some assistant coaches. You know, I've helped coach, so sometimes that's what I've done. Maybe that's part of it. We also work in a low-income apartment complex. I got a follow-up call with the manager over there. She is wonderful. She's a white lady, and she serves this neighborhood where two of the two times I went there was there were shootings. Right before I got there, I drove by the police car. Mom was in the car. She had just shot the boyfriend, and the police were trying to see if it was incidental or purposeful. And so, but she's right there, and she's like, yeah, D'Amico, there was just a shooting. She shot him. They're trying to see. And so, but she's right there. She loves that neighborhood, and she served that neighborhood so well. She knows that neighborhood so good. So, but what we did, we started a community garden. So like urban gardening. And we started it. Now it's growing, it's thriving. And it was cool just working with the neighbors with that. And, you know, also like not underestimating like the gathering of the saints. And so we're trying to get more people in our local church. We also know that that's a struggle. And so like, we're okay with that. And like, success for us isn't like butts in seats. Success for us is faithfulness for decades, and getting to love and serve our neighbors, even if they never worship with us on a Sunday. Like, if we got to pray for them, if we got to serve them, like, that's success for us. And just making sure we have the right metrics. And then like for the folks that are a part of our local church, we're working intently on their devotion to Jesus, making sure they have a vibrant worship life, and then also that they're resting to the best that they can. In a city that's as busy and as transient as Houston, people work really hard, but we're also trying to model for them, like, okay, how are you resting? How are you retreating? You know, what does solitude with Jesus look like for you? Even if that's 30 minutes, an hour, you're probably doing more than most folks that are in our neighborhood. And honestly, we're also a young church. So what we're striving to do is aspirational, but we're making strides towards that. Even like my parents have a food truck, and that they now live in our neighborhood. So I'm trying to put them to work. And so want to start.
Yeah.
So our neighborhood, man, there's just like, if we want to eat something, man, just not anything good to eat. Like it's all fast food. And so we're trying to conquer that, where it's like, okay, if you want something good to eat, what if the church is the answer to that, where we provide what our neighborhood needs? So we need good food to eat. We need a breakfast spot. We need a lunch spot. So we're trying to step into those things too.
Dining and art. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things that revitalize any area.
Mm, I love
and
that.
And so we found like the artists, this is what's so hard, is like the creatives.
Yep.
Get their ball moving, and then business comes in because it becomes a hot spot. But then business drives the price up, which makes the artist have to leave. And then when the artist leaves, then the business drives the area into decline.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they don't realize that that's the, you know, it's the cycle that we go on.
Yeah.
So how do you get the artists and the entrepreneurs to work together to create the ecosystem, and they both mutually are beneficial of each other?
Yeah.
And I look at a place like you're at, the type of art that has to happen to be vibrant, that doesn't kick people out.
Yeah, that's so good.
So I was thinking about Omaha. There's this area that is really awesome. It's very artistic.
Yeah.
But the type of art that's there fits the neighborhood. And then, but that's not who used to live there.
Right.
You know, it's not who the community was. So I think, you know, Black artists coming in that area provides a way for, okay, could there be Black owned businesses or businesses that care about that area staying diverse?
Yeah, that's good.
Right.
Good.
But it is the arts that creates the attraction.
Yeah, that's so good. So to that, one of the churches that we were a part of here in Houston, they would do an art residency just because of the purpose that you're describing, where one of the struggles that artists have is gallery space. It's so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if they have a piece that they really want to charge $300 or $400 for, because they're now in an expensive gallery space, they maybe have to charge $1,000. And so that piece doesn't move. And so what this church, what Soldier Montrose did, they offered free gallery space and an art residency so that they had a place to then offer to the artists so that they can put their art on display. And so you just give me something to think about. We have there's a brother, his name's Brian Ellison. He's doing a lot of amazing work. He has an organization called the Black Man Project, and he does a lot of work with like the mental health of Black men in our community. But he also is an artist. I think he got his master's PhD from University of Houston. But he's done like some really amazing like think pieces, like one of which he is like walking on a treadmill in a business suit. And I think he's like trying to describe like what it's like, you know, sometimes for Black men to try to keep up in these corporate spaces. And so it was very provocative and thought. And then like he sometimes like sat in like the middle of downtown, and he has maybe like had people like write notes, you know, that they want to like write to encourage. So he's awesome. But that's a very strong point that you made about dining and art. And when we were talking about our brother in Phoenix, Juan Sanchez, Juan at Collective Coffee, what he's done in his coffee shop, pretty much everything that happens in that coffee shop is from the community. So all of the pieces that have been done in there, local artists, mostly all of the baked goods. I think he's a Latino brother, but I think he gets his baked goods from this Black woman. And so like, he's very strategic in what he does. So I would love to do something like that. But I also know that I learned it from John Uwechekwa, who has Portrait Coffee in Atlanta. He's like, you got to have a team. So admittedly, I'm kind of like what I've seen some of these mega churches do, where they're like recruiting talent, where they're like straight up jacking the best worship leaders. I'm like thinking through I'm seeing like people working at coffee shops.
Go to the mega churches and poach their entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Because they're not using them anyway.
Right. Yeah. No, that's
you get all of our good musicians, we'll take your entrepreneurs.
Yeah. That's a good word. But yeah, just thinking through like, okay, who can be on my team?
Yeah.
So that we can build this thing out. Now, our neighborhood, like location, 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 that's going to be the question. Where? Because like that's the internal struggle with me. Is like, where do we put it? Because like, there's a tension to put it in a nicer area, because I see that where people go to like where it's nicer. But I'm like, man, like I want our neighbors to be able to enjoy a good meal, a good cup of coffee.
I know a friend of mine revitalized an entire downtown of a dying town.
Wow.
And now, right outside of Columbus, they're now the best place to live in Columbus. And they're 45 minutes outside of Columbus.
Wow.
And he did it over 15 years. And the first thing he decided to put in was a pizza place. Because people needed a sit-down pizza place they could go to on a Friday or a Saturday.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that kicked it off, is they created a decent concept around it. Now it's won the World Pizza Championships like two or three times.
Wow.
You know? So, and that, you know, that really helps. But then from there, it was, I mean, let's say pizza. And then I think it was the Mexican restaurant right afterwards.
Wow.
And then, so they had a couple different, now they have two coffee shops in town. They have a breakfast place. They have a bunch of different shops downtown. Totally changed the vibe of that entire area. But when you're thinking community of development and church planting, urban church planting,
yeah,
you're not thinking, how do I get people to come to my church? You're thinking,
yeah,
how do I make this place better?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I think like whenever, like I think about a example of like, there's a abandoned house across the street from us. It's burned down now, but I remember when I first saw it and there was like illegal activity happened there. Like there's a story I can share off air, but like some bad things happened at that house. But I was just like, I don't want this to be like this. And so I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like telling somebody like, man, I want to fix this house up and make it better. So these bad things aren't happening. And so like it was a real estate developer. He's like, you're a problem solver. It was like, you see these problems and you want to make it better. And like, I'm seeing these things in my neighborhood, and to what your friend was doing in Columbus. Like I see all this potential where like our neighborhood is bringing the housing, but the businesses aren't there. The restaurants aren't there. And I'm like, you know, and wanting, and it's even like, even hotels. So we got a group that's coming, I think in September, end of August, September. And they're like, hey, where can we stay? And like, there's nowhere in our neighborhood. And so what this one guy met in Lynn, Massachusetts, they had the same problem, and they've done phenomenal work. Like I wanted to be this guy's friend so bad. And I straight up asked him like, man, can I be your friend? Like, just like that. And he had so many words like, man, I ain't really that got time. And his wife was so kind. Like, I could be your friend. He doesn't have time. I could be your friend. But, but they had that same problem, and their answer to that, they bought a big house and they converted it. And now they answered the question of like, where can you stay when you come to Lynn, Massachusetts? And now they have a place. And so now I'm thinking like, man, where is a big house that we can renovate so that when missionaries want to come and serve us, we got a place. And those are the things that I'm thinking through too. So we've
that's so good.
We've helped people like in transition whenever they need a place to live. So now I'm working through rental houses. Like how can I utilize our partners to maybe even pay the mortgage on this house that we have that's specifically for people in transition, so that for a month or two they don't have to worry about paying rent, and then we can help them bank that money to then help them with that next thing. And so just thinking through that. And then there's a ministry in our neighborhood. They started a bread making enterprise. It's called Rise Bread Making. And so they work with brothers and sisters, mostly brothers now, who are formerly incarcerated or coming out of homelessness. But as a way to help those brothers pay their rent, now they have an artisan bread making company. And I was reading a book called Ecosystems of Jubilee. And in this book, they were doing something very similar. The first story they shared was not a success story, but they shared it because they were trying to answer the question of like, how can we help and serve our neighbors? But with this brother who he's connected to, they're connected to a large Presbyterian church, and they have people who have resources. There's probably some billionaires at that church. And so they're able to tap in and figure out, like, how can we make sure that these brothers have what they need? Because they're doing amazing work. But sometimes it's like they can't, these brothers can't pay their rent because they can't find meaningful employment. So they answer that question, like, how can our neighbors have meaningful employment so they can pay their bills and make sure that their basic needs are met?
That's so good. That's very good. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I could talk about this all day. I think we need more church plants in urban settings.
Yeah.
And we need more people that are planting, not thinking about building the event, but building the city.
That's good.
And when you do that, you're just going to see gospel transformation all over the place. So that's really cool. And listen, I love to preach. I love the big show. I enjoy mega church. So this is not a knock against them, but I think we still have to think about, why did we get into this in the first place? And watch the lost meet Jesus and be a part of that process and watch their lives turn around. And so I love what you're doing, D'Amico. It's great.
Thank you, brother. Yeah, man. And
absolutely,
I'm grateful. Grateful to be on Team Jesus, because, man, I'm grateful to be serving the Lord in this way and just getting to talk about his kingdom, this upside down kingdom where the first will be last and the last will be first. Where it's gonna be full of misfits and people who don't fit the status quo, and so just loving serving where we are and just getting a chance to, like you were describing, have people know that they're known and loved by the God of the universe.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot. This has been fun.
Yeah, man, I enjoyed it.
All right, next time. Well, next month, you'll hear us again. It's going to be fun. We'll see you guys later.
Peace.